From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Iran used the one-year anniversary of President Trump's decision to pull out of the Obama-era nuclear deal to announce it will stop complying with portions of the deal. President Hassan Rouhani said in 60 days, Iran will stop exporting excess uranium and heavy water. Now, those were two requirements of the deal to make sure the country sent away uranium used in producing electricity so it couldn't be used to be enriched and build a nuclear weapon. By all accounts, including the UN inspectors, Iran was complying with the deal even after the U.S. pulled out and imposed sanctions and took away waivers that had allowed other countries to buy oil from Iran. Jim Walsh is Here Now security analyst. He's with MIT Security Studies program. He joins us in the studio. And Jim, you remind us that those waivers not only allowed other countries to buy oil from Iran to prop up its economy, but what?
Well, the waivers allowed the non-proliferation parts of the deal to work.
Because they took away the uranium.
Right. So back in 2010, 2011, everyone was very excited and concerned that Iran was stockpiling low-enriched uranium and heavy water. And they feared, well, if they had a big pile of it, they might divert it to a weapons program. So we wrote a deal that said, beyond a certain threshold, you have to export it. And then we impose sanctions on shippers this week, on shippers who would take that stuff away, which would be a non-proliferation win. And so so the Iranians said, okay, fine, then we won't export it.
Well, how would they get rid of the uranium as required by the deal if not with shippers who would take it away?
Well, I guess they could pour it down the drain or into the ocean or something. But insofar as they need an international business to help them, that part is going away. Now, they are entitled to do this. If you go to page 13 of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action and look at section 26, it says, if the U.S. reimposes sanctions, Iran claims the right to back off some of its commitments. Now, these are small. I want to emphasize these are small, and Iran said it's doing this, but it wants to stay in the agreement. It wants the agreement to work, but people have to step up to save it. Mm. Now, 60 days from now, I think if they do take additional actions, then those would be more significant.
If we start seeing them enriching uranium.
At a higher level,
I hear the incredulity in your voice. Because it is hard to understand if somebody's complying with a deal, why you are then bringing the stick down on them because they're already complying with the deal.
Right,
supporters of the president's plan say that Iran is backing groups like Hezbollah. They want other changes from Iran. As we hear others say, they want Iran not to be Iran.
Yes.
What is your sense of how this is going to work?
Yeah, I think you've put your finger on it. This is an identity issue. It's not about policy. It's hard to negotiate on identity. We don't want Iran to be Iran. This was never about nuclear weapons or nuclear proliferation. If it was, we never would have pulled out of the agreement. And the fact that we're sanctioning firms, making it harder for the non-proliferation parts of the agreement to work, sort of shows that this is just about Iran. We hate Iran, we love Saudi Arabia, and we're just going to keep beating it with a stick till we get what we want.
Well, but, you talked about 60 days from now, this could be very ugly. But in the meantime, what happens to the other countries that are still in the deal? I mean, are they being forced to choose between Iran and the U.S.?
Yes, and there are two countries or sets of countries where this is playing out the biggest. One is China. China does not want to end buying oil from Iran. And it's unclear. There's been very little reporting about what has happened after the May 2nd announcement on those waivers. But China is not pleased. The other are the Europeans. And we have sanctioned everyone so much, so often, for so long, that we have forced our friends, the Europeans, to try to devise a scheme that would allow them to get around the U.S. sanctions, around the U.S. banking system, and deliver humanitarian aid. That is not a good thing for us. Probably isn't going to work anytime soon. But if they were able to figure it out, that would be a gun aimed at a major economic asset for the United States, which is we control the banking system.
Well, and speaking of sanctions, how bad is Iran's economy right now?
Well, I think it's bad. The chief consequence of sanctions, every study will tell you, is corruption. I think that's probably strengthening the Revolutionary Guard. It makes things more expensive for average people. But if you're hoping that they're going to get up and rally and throw out the bums, normally when a foreign power threatens a country, that leads to a rally around the flag result, not a throw the bums out effect.
Yeah. Jim Walsh, Here Now security analyst. He's with MIT Security Studies program. We think you're hearing that you are worried about these events?
Yeah, I am. I can think of at least four scenarios in which this actually leads to an armed conflict. So I am concerned about it.
Okay. Well, we are now too. Thank you.
All right. Well, it has been a wet spring in most of this country, but drier than normal in parts of the Pacific Northwest. Washington Governor Jay Inslee recently declared a drought emergency for two regions in the north central part of his state. And that's making people nervous, especially those around an area that burned in the Carlton Complex fire 5 years ago. It was the largest wildfire in state history. Ashley Ahern reports.
It's been really dry this spring in the Methow Valley. The creeks that would normally be gushing as the snow drains off the landscape are low. You go to the hardware store or the coffee shop, and people are talking about it. Drive down the dirt road, and people are burning piles of brush to get their properties ready for yet another wildfire season. Elise Walker manages a community news and information Facebook group with more than 9,000 members. She says during wildfire season, traffic in the group doubles, and things are already picking up. Several small fires or escaped burn piles have been reported in just the past few days.
You know, so another post. Good job, guys. See, like these are all comments and posts and stuff.
You're just scrolling through and it's just all lighting up as new posts.
Everything here is posts and comments.
At her home, Walker has three radio scanners and an array of big antennas. She leaves the scanners blasting all night.
And it's funny because it's like being a mom. Every sound that you hear just goes on without you. And then as soon as you hear the baby whimper, you're like wide awake, you know? That's how it is for me. Like the conversations are nothing until I hear a single way they speak or a word or the tones. And I'm just like, bing, wide awake. I can hear it and I'll listen.
And then she'll update the Facebook group. Sharing information is her way of coping with the anxiety of fire season. A sort of self-care by informing others. She says it's clear to her that people in the group are struggling and triggered by the slightest hint of fire danger.
If we're not giving the information people are posting to the group, tell me what's going on. Where were the trucks going in Winthrop at full speed? You can get that sense of urgency from people because they're so absorbed during fire season. They just can't stop themselves, you know, and it's mostly people who have lost everything. It's a big deal.
Dagmar DeVere is a member and frequent poster in Walker's Facebook group. She lost her home in the Carlton Complex fire just 2 weeks after she and her husband Warren moved in.
Right after the fire, I was done with life. I stopped going out into public totally, entirely. I couldn't talk about anything else but what happened and the fires. That was it. My social life came to an end. Being able to work came to an end. Just like that. Boom. Done.
We're standing in the kitchen of her double-wide mobile home, on the same property where the previous one burned. The space is crowded with close to 200 imitation Tiffany lamps. DeVere had a big collection that was lost in the fire, and she said looking for replacements on eBay helped her recover.
Let me turn on some of these lamps for you.
So this is where the magic happens, huh?
Oh, yeah.
The Facebook page is up?
Definitely. Yeah. As you can see, I keep track of all these fires.
Anyhow, why do you do that?
Been to have knowledge so I can live here. Only with knowledge. That's the only way from knowing what's going on around me.
DeVere says during fire season, she stays up most of the night looking for information online. Her Facebook posts are almost always in all capital letters. She saw a therapist for a while, but then the therapist relocated and it was too much money to drive to the new location. So she stopped going. Twig Wheeler lives in an off-grid house less than a mile from where the Carlton Complex fire started. He stayed to fight the fire as it burned around the edge of his property.
That gave me this opportunity to see how it works, to see how appropriate preparation can help us to help me to relate to it. But this is the big thing. All of my preparation with it made me feel engaged.
Wheeler is a trauma expert and counselor. He says it's understandable that wildfire season can raise anxiety levels. People can feel paralyzed and draw inward. Wheeler says it's better to take action. Get your property fire ready, stay informed, but most importantly, stay connected with your community. Socializing, he says, is like a stand down signal for your stressed out nervous system.
That is very much a deactivation signal that needs to be inserted in all of these communities that are, I know it's crazy to say, having, quote, natural disasters. It'd be a strange response, but it's actually a very important prospect to bring people together to try to have a good time in the midst of the dangers.
And as Elise Walker tells the members of her Facebook group, reach out when you're feeling overwhelmed. You're not alone.
Like in our group, if you post something that says, I need help getting my house ready for fire season, I can guarantee you there's people who would jump to help because we're all there. So instead of stressing and worrying, it's time to just say, I need help, to arm themselves with information and give yourself a break. This is how it's going to be. And you could only do what you can do.
For Here and Now, I'm Ashley Ahern in Carleton, Washington.
Outside New York's Museum of Jewish Heritage, there is a stunning sight, a huge brown cattle car that was used to transport Jews and others to the Nazi concentration camp Auschwitz. It's part of a new exhibit opening today, put together by preservationist and historian Robert Jan van Pelt. Hundreds of rare artifacts, including this cattle car. How many people would have been in here?
Around 80 people.
We know that when this was first brought here, a sacred moment for so many people, that there was an actual 92-year-old who came to witness this, who'd ridden in one of these. Yeah. I can't imagine that emotion.
Now, yeah, I think what we need to realize is that if we think about the Holocaust as a space, then your world gets contracted as persecution begins. And at a certain moment, you're arrested. And now it's contract to the moment that you're with 80 people in this dark space, but still your family is with you. Yeah. And then, of course, the moment that the door opens, you arrive in Auschwitz, all of that disappears in the flesh. Because now everyone gets separated without opportunity to say goodbyes.
And do you worry that this might be too emotional? I mean, there are many museums around, but this is...
When we opened in Madrid, my 92-year-old father went through the exhibition and he collapsed in tears. And I thought, actually, he would die. But, you know, you cannot live without risks, and you cannot in some way research history without risks. History is not safe.
Inside the spacious Museum of Jewish Heritage, we're greeted by Museum Board Chair Bruce Ratner, who first saw the Auschwitz exhibit in Spain.
It was difficult. I had lost a number of members of my family.
And here you are, though. You're already in a place that will bring you to tears. How does this go beyond that?
It's almost difficult to describe because 700 artifacts and objects, 400 photographs, it's so detailed, and the artifacts are so meaningful that you can't help by being impacted in a way that I've never been impacted by any exhibition.
We enter through a long, dark hallway filled with home movies of European Jews carefree before the war. A quote on the wall from Auschwitz survivor and author Primo Levi.
It happened, therefore it can happen again.
We've now entered a very dark room. I'm looking over here. We see barbed wire. Are these the actual cement pillars?
Yes, they are from the camp itself.
Huge cement posts with barbed wire strung along them as fencing. You can possibly get out this. And this is all from the camp.
Yes, yeah.
We're now riding up an escalator, which, where are we going? I mean, I just had the sense of what that must be like to get on a train or to just, I am just doing what you tell me to do.
Yes, exactly. And this is, in that sense, we exploit the architecture of this building.
As we move through the rooms with Robert Jan van Pelt, we move through history, showing just how the Nazis were able to build on populist hate of the other. How Pope Honorius decreed that Jews wear oval badges in the 1200s. How, in the early 1900s, French scholar Paul de Lagarde proposed that all Jews be sent to Madagascar, a plan the Nazis later proposed as well. Everywhere there are photos and mementos that become totems, everyday items made sacred. We turn a corner, in a glass case, a simple white medical coat and some medical devices.
In fact, we have here one of the most chilling artifacts in the exhibition. When the war broke out, the Germans also started to killing the disabled. So this was basically the first massacres was on German disabled people. Dr. Georg Renno murdered more than 20,000 people.
Because they were disabled?
Because they were disabled. when basically we are willing, when we accept that we are going to kill our own people who are not capable of functioning in the racially pure society, who can stop us to kill the others?
Well, here's a quote in 1997. Yeah. He said he didn't feel guilty. He'd brought his victims relief.
We arrive now in Auschwitz with the deportees. We see a display with suitcases. And one suitcase in this case has a name on it. And we researched who this person was. And so we tell the story. We have a special display here that is in some way a memorial to the children who were murdered shortly after their arrival.
It's very painful. There's two little children's outfits, one a little dress, one a onesie, and a little, looks like a handmade doll, some buttons, lots of buttons. I see, even though you, who this you live with this, it feels that seeing this has...
Oh, yeah,
even
I have tears in my eyes right now. Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm watering up. So, no, this is every... You don't never get used to this. I mean, I can talk about it and so, but this is, you know, in some way the core of the Holocaust is the murder of the children. And we're basically now in a display that deals with undressing room, the gas chambers, and the ovens.
And we have a shoe.
It is a shoe. If you look very carefully at it, it was repaired many times. Probably a hand-me-down the shoe from one brother to the next one. Inside the shoe, the sock is still tucked. We literally look at the last act of a little boy. Yeah, mother says, you know, okay, put your sock in the shoe, like any mother will say when you go to the swimming pool, yeah? Because I don't want you to lose your sock. So dutifully, this boy puts the sock in the shoe, is now naked to go to the showers, and he does it because he expects to come back. And of course he doesn't come back.
In this large space stands a full shower room. We stand outside the door, which has a peephole.
This side is the perpetrator's side. There's all the hardware to open and close the door. Yeah.
And now we go around
and
the back.
And now we go to the other side. There's no hardware anymore. There's no way that anyone cramped in this room would be able to do anything. So for me, I'm just trying to imagine. I mean, this is, again, for me, very emotional. Because you're crammed with 2,000 people in a gas chamber of 200 square meters. Yeah. There's nothing you can do anymore. You're naked, this door closes, the gas comes in, so column like this, and the only agency you have left is try to break that little peephole. As if it will make any difference.
This is very uncomfortable. I don't want to think about that.
Now, I don't actually want you to think about it. I want you to feel it. What I do hope that when you come into this room is that you feel there is something fundamentally wrong. Fundamentally wrong here.
We move on through a room with a huge barracks, a stretcher that carried the dead, another room dedicated to the resistance, and finally, one honoring the liberation, little tins of condensed milk the prisoners found after the SS abandoned the camps.
We also have the only window that looks outside.
Yeah. Yeah, we're finally able to see the Statue of Liberty. Right through this window at this museum. That's amazing.
Yeah, so we designed it that we would have this view.
And here, another glass case with a beautiful bathrobe made from what looks like gray wool. Robert tells us the story of Jakob Grunbaum, a tailor whose family was murdered at Auschwitz. After liberation, he took a job as a tailor for the American Occupation Army, heard about an abandoned warehouse full of Nazi uniforms.
So Jakob goes into that warehouse, he takes a bale of that material, and out of this SS uniform material makes himself a house robe. Mm-hmm. Now think about it. This man had been a slave. Miraculously he survived. So one thing that he did not have for 6 years was an opportunity or a place to wear a house robe. And he creates this house robe out of SS uniform material. Mm-hmm. And he ends up marrying a local girl, actually, who converts to Judaism. And the girl is my mother-in-law.
No. Yeah. Wait. You met your wife, who is also in this research field. You met her at the modern Auschwitz.
Yeah.
And this is
her father's story.
Yeah. So this is so personal for you.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, this is, I mean, I don't think that you get into this field if it's not personal. There are many children of survivors, grandchildren. All of us struggle in some way what we do with that legacy.
Finally, a sun-filled exit. We see the same happy families we saw as we entered. We can leave. They can't.
And then we come here to the last message we want to give.
The words of an Auschwitz survivor.
You who are passing by, I beg you, do something. Learn a dance step. Something to justify your existence. Something that gives you the right to be dressed in your skin and in your body hair. Learn to walk and to laugh, because it would be too senseless, after all, for so many to have died while you live doing nothing with your life.
What do you expect to happen, Robert, when you send people out?
I hope that they appreciate how precious this life is.
Our visit to the new Auschwitz exhibit, Not Long Ago, Not Far Away, that opens today at New York's Museum of Jewish Heritage. Our guide, Robert Jan van Pelt, who is also an architect and painfully aware that architects had to design Auschwitz. He said he began his research to try to figure out why. We also spoke with Bruce Ratner, Museum Board Chair.
This message comes from Here and Now's sponsor, Ember Wave. Ember Wave, the revolutionary new personal thermostat that is designed to help you find thermal wellness in any situation. Ember Wave can put you in control of your comfort in places like your freezing office, uncomfortable airplanes, cold restaurants, after a workout, at home, and more. Named one of Time Magazine's best inventions of 2018. Learn more at emberwave.com. Ember Wave, balance through temperature.
A charter school in a Denver suburb is closed for the rest of the week after authorities say two suspects opened fire there yesterday, killing one student and injuring eight others. The STEM school, Highlands Ranch, is a K-12 school. It's just 7 miles from Columbine High School, so this is an area that is very familiar with gun violence. Here's George Brockler today. He's the DA for Colorado's 18th Judicial District.
And if you had suggested to anyone behind me or in this room that within 20 years and 20 miles, we would have dealt with Columbine, Aurora Theater, Arapahoe High School, the shooting of Zach Parrish and four other deputies, we'd have thought you mad. And yet here we are again.
Joining us now is John Daly. He's a reporter at Colorado Public Radio. And John, this is just stunning to hear that students there as young as 8 years old had been trained to deal with active shooter situations. And we've been seeing these pictures of these little kids coming out of the school with their hands up over their heads. What are we learning today about how this shooting unfolded?
Well, the sheriff held a press conference just earlier today with the DA who we just heard from, and they have identified the suspect in the shooting as 18-year-old Devin Erickson. There's a second suspect that's a juvenile who's not been identified. They say that the shooting happened a little bit before 2 yesterday. There was a call to police around that time from a school administrator, and there's a police substation right nearby. And they rushed into the school. They were able to get the two suspects into custody within minutes. And the sheriff today said that the deputies did not exchange gunfire with the suspects. He did say they were using pistols in the assault. The two suspects were apprehended separately. The sheriff,
and is it thought that they were students at the school?
Yes. Yes, the sheriff said that they were students at the school.
As far as mass shootings go and school shootings go, this one was rare because there were two suspects in this case, but there were also 9 victims. What can you tell us about them?
That's right. 9 victims. There's a 18-year-old male student named Kendrick Castillo. The police confirmed his name. He died. There are 8 other students that were injured. They were taken to nearby hospitals, and they've 5 have been released, and there are 3 that are still in intensive care in the hospital.
The bigger context here is that it was like a month ago. This school was one of dozens around Denver that was closed when an armed woman who was obsessed with the Columbine shooting was in the area. She was later found dead, but it was a big deal for the people around there. This is recently. We've seen the 20th anniversary of the Columbine shooting pass. This just must be an emotionally overwhelming time for people there.
I think it is. You know, this community has been through a lot with Columbine and then the incident that you just referenced in recent weeks. So I would say folks are on edge. Folks are rattled. And it's very unsettling for sure.
That's John Daly, a reporter for Colorado Public Radio, with the latest on the school shooting at the STEM school, Highlands Ranch. John, thanks for speaking with us.
You bet.
The New York Times is reporting today that it was given tax figures, not returns, from someone with legal access to them, which show that between 1985 and 95, citizen Donald Trump lost more than $1 billion in assets from casinos to retail space. The White House says the information is false, but the reporting comes as the Treasury Department is refusing to turn over the president's tax returns, as requested by House Democrats. David K. Johnston is founder of the nonprofit DCReport.org. His latest book is It's Even Worse Than You Think, What the Trump Administration is Doing to America. So, David, you clearly have a point of view here.
Oh, well, sure. I mean, I've been revealing for 30 years that Donald Trump is not who he presents himself to be. He is, at this point, the most successful con artist in the history of the world, and he's the third generation head of a white-collar crime family.
Okay, you're going to have to back that up. So let's start doing that. You did reporting back in 1990 in which you concluded that while Donald Trump was saying he was worth $3 billion at that time, he had a negative net worth. Talk a little more about that. And also, did you learn anything new in today's New York Times reporting?
Well, when I broke the story in April of 1990 that Trump was no billionaire, he went around for 4 months calling me a liar, and then he had to put into the public record his own statements, and they showed he had a negative net worth at the time of $295 million. The Times reporting today, which is based on reliable documents, this is the IRS tax transcripts, it's the key information on your tax return, shows losses of over $1 billion over 11 tax years. That's much bigger than I ever would have imagined. 1 year, Trump alone accounted for almost 2 cents on every dollar of tax losses reported all across America.
Okay, well, David K. Johnston, I mean, if it's true, why is that important?
Well, it matters on a number of levels. I mean, first of all, there's a basic function of integrity and decency. If someone blatantly lies about those things, can we trust you about other things? Secondly, people who are constantly desperately in need of another injection of cash are exactly the kind of people who become compromised by foreign spy agencies. There are a number of squirrely business deals that I and other people have written about that make no sense whatsoever between Trump and Russians in terms of traditional business, but they make perfect sense if they're money laundering, which is a crime.
Well, and that's quite an accusation, you know, that you make, and this is one of the reasons that people want to see these tax returns to see exactly what may be there. But quick question before we move on to some of the legal avenues being tried right now. If these documents were leaked to the Times, could the president's tax returns be leaked? Is that possible?
Yeah. Well, remember, I got the summary pages of his 2005 tax return 2 years ago. And his New York state tax returns are virtually identical to his federal returns. And he is under active investigation by the New York State Attorney General, Letitia James. In addition, there's legislation moving through the New York legislature that would allow his tax returns to be shared with Congress, his state tax returns with Congress. So, yes, I think we will eventually see many years of Donald Trump's tax returns.
But people also point to a very clear past that Donald Trump has had in the courts in difficulty with his taxes. Let's listen, first of all, during the campaign, the candidate Donald Trump was asked about whether he used a big real estate loss in the 1990s to avoid paying federal income taxes for years. This is sound from a debate in October of 2016, the candidate Hillary Clinton also on the stage, the moderator CNN's Anderson Cooper.
Did you use that $916 million loss to avoid paying personal federal income taxes?
Of course I do. Of course I do. And so do all of her donors, or most of her donors. I know many of her donors. Her donors took massive tax write-offs.
So have you paid personal federal income taxes?
A lot of my write-off was depreciation and other things that Hillary, as a senator, allowed.
Well, then-candidate Clinton went on to say she tried to make changes to tax law but couldn't because she was serving under a Republican president. But put that aside, David K. Johnston. You know, the president has always said that what he does is legal. Everybody who's smart does it. But you point to two trials where, you know, judges did not agree.
That's right. Donald Trump had two income tax fraud trials. These are civil, not criminal trials. And he not only lost both of them, but he was excoriated by the judges. And at one of the trials, Jack Mitnick, his longtime tax lawyer and accountant, who also was his father's tax advisor, testified under oath, "That's my signature, but neither I nor my firm prepared that tax return." That's extraordinary evidence of fraud and would qualify for criminal prosecution if the government had chosen to do so at the time. Donald Trump's statement during the debate has an element of truth in it. Absolutely wealthy real estate families who are successful generally do not pay income taxes. What Trump didn't say is that the $918 million deduction that he took was losses already taken by the banks. So instead of reporting $918 million of income and paying taxes on it because he borrowed money he did not pay back, he deducted the same losses the banks took. That's fraud.
Okay, let's talk about the attempts by Congress to get his tax returns today and distinguish the legal avenues. There is the 1924, I think, law having to do with the Teapot Dome scandal that gave Congress the right to ask for anyone's tax returns. There's also the congressional role of oversight and the right to subpoena. If Congress needs documents to see if laws need to be strengthened, if there's corruption, in other words, to legislate. And you know, Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin says he won't comply with congressional requests for documents because he said that the request from Democrats lacks a legitimate legislative purpose. You say what, David K. Johnston, about the refusal to turn over these tax returns?
Well, under the 1924 law, Congress has the right to inspect tax returns upon written request. There is no case in which this law has not been complied with until the Trump administration. And by the way, if you want to argue legislative purpose is necessary or investigative and oversight function is necessary, we got lots of reasons to do that. Mm-hmm. There is an abundant public record now that shows that Donald Trump has cheated on his taxes in the past. The question we should really be asking is, why are they so desperate to hide his returns? And I think the answer is very clear. The returns with a proper audit will show that, like Richard Nixon, Donald Trump is a criminal-level tax cheat.
Well, is that what you want to see? Because it seems as if there's a history of that. Or do you think you can also see monies that, you know, you can trace to Russia?
Well, one of the reasons we should be concerned about Trump's tax returns is compromising people. It is ancient spycraft to find people who are in possession of secrets or power or access and to feed them money when they're desperate. The tax returns are not going to be so blatant as to tell us this was a payoff or this was a bribe. But Congress has real tax experts who can go through Trump's tax returns and conduct audits. That's how they caught Richard Nixon as a major league tax cheat.
You also say that not only does the law say that when someone is asked for their tax returns, that person shall turn them over, but you say that the people within the government who blunt that, let's say IRS Commissioner Charles Rettig or Treasury Secretary Mnuchin, they also may be punished for not turning them over?
Yeah. Failure to comply with the tax laws and interfering with them makes you subject to 5 years in prison if you're prosecuted. And under what's called a delegation order, the person responsible for turning over the tax returns is Charles Rettig, But the person who is refusing to comply with the law is Steve Mnuchin. And I suspect that Rettig, concerned that he could go to jail and lose his California law license, is refusing to violate the law. That's why Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, is handling this. But the law is very clear. The duty here is with Charles Rettig, the IRS commissioner, under this delegation order.
David K. Johnson, you've just listed so many things that we already know about President Trump and Citizen Trump's tax returns. What do you say to the people who say, enough already? I mean, you know, if you haven't found it by now, what more do you need to know?
Well, we have found it. I mean, that's the shocking thing here is we've found plenty of evidence. What we don't have are the last 6 years of tax returns. And that's why Congress wants to see these, and it's an entirely legitimate thing to do because Donald Trump is not above the law. He is our employee under our Constitution. He works for us, and he needs to be as accountable as you, Robin, and me.
David K. Johnston, investigative reporter with the nonprofit DCReport.org. David, thanks as always.
Thank you.
An animal that's been called the Loch Ness Monster of the Sea has returned to the waters off California. Researchers say that schools of basking sharks, which are commonly confused with their more ferocious cousins, the great white, have resurfaced in an area where they once thrived. Heidi Dewar is a research biologist with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration in La Jolla. Heidi, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you very much.
Tell me about these animals, because obviously most people haven't seen one before, and yet they are gigantic, apparently as big as a yacht.
Yeah, they're actually California's largest shark, and the great white sharks get a lot of attention. But it's been a very long time since we've seen a lot of basking sharks in the area, so people haven't really even been aware that they are part of California's natural fauna.
There's no risk to humans with these sharks, right? They just eat plankton and krill, even though they swim with their mouth wide open.
Yeah, but they're kind of like baleen whales, and both of the largest sharks are like baleen whales in that they're filter feeders. So some of the largest creatures in the sea are eating some of the smallest creatures in the sea, and they just have itty-bitty little teeth and then these large, really long comb-like rakers that they use to filter out little crustaceans out of the water, like little copepods.
It's a shark that used to be quite common off the coast of California, but then they started disappearing around the early 1900s, what happened?
Well, we're not sure exactly what happened. First, there were some targeted fisheries off of California where they would catch, you know, hundreds to a thousand animals. And then they also get caught as bycatch, so unintentionally in fisheries sometimes. And then the other source of mortality is in Canada, the basking sharks were a nuisance to their salmon fishermen. They would swim into the nets and destroy the nets. And so the Canadians had an eradication program that ended in 1970, where they took like 1,000 to 2,000 animals. So there's sort of those three sources of mortality.
And is it true that the oil inside these basking sharks at one point was very prized and valuable, and it was used to power things like lamps?
Yeah, they actually, the liver and the oil in the liver, it was very valuable. And a fair number of marine animals were taken for that kind of oil.
Whales as well, yeah.
And it actually was used in bombs in World War II. So that was, you know, another time when they took animals. It was around World War II to help them make their bombs.
Okay, so fast forward to today. Now, people are spotting these animals again in the Santa Barbara Channel. We're also seeing reports off of Ventura and Long Beach. What are your theories about what's going on?
It's a little too early to say conclusively what's going on. We hope, certainly, that it's a sign of recovery, but we need to collect data over a longer period of time to really figure that out. There were a few things that happened about 30 years or 20 or so years ago in the early 90s that reduced overall mortality to basking sharks in the Pacific. One, on the high seas, they banned those high seas drift nets, and we know the basking sharks were caught there. There's probably still a little bit of illegal fishing, but not nearly to the scale that there used to be. So that's one thing that would have helped the population. Another thing is California pushed the net-based fisheries out of state waters, which was 3 nautical miles. So now all the nets are 3 nautical miles offshore. And that protected this important coastal habitat, because that's often where we see them, you know, in the old aerial surveys. And when we get sightings, we see them within the coastal state waters. So those two things probably reduced mortality. And if this is a recovery, would have contributed to that.
But on the other hand, there have been a lot of sort of weird things happening on the west coast of California over the last couple of years. This spring, a hoodwinker sunfish, which had never before been spotted in the northern hemisphere, washed up on a California beach. We've seen reports of warm water jellyfish and crabs and sea anemones making their way north to California. So, you know, on the one hand, we thought that the basking shark revival might be a good news story. But maybe it's a sign of something a little bit more ominous going on in the world's oceans. What do you think?
Well, I mean, that's certainly a possibility. And we don't know enough about their movements or their habitats to know, you know, to even understand like what's going to happen with a change in the environment. Usually what we see with warm water events is we see a northward movement of tropical species. And basking shark is more a temperate species. So it's not like they used to see a bunch off Mexico and now we're seeing a bunch off California. So I'm not sure that warm water is an explanation. But having said that, you know, we really don't have the baseline information to understand what normal behaviors are, you know, which makes it even harder to figure out what will happen in abnormal conditions.
That's Heidi Dewar, a research biologist with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration in La Jolla, California. Heidi, thanks for taking the time to speak with us. We appreciate it.
You're welcome. It was my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.